Quadruple quandary for the dear leader. Shortly after midnight, the gates opened, as they had done so often before, and a couple of swarthy-looking gentlemen slipped out without a word and disappeared into the night. They pilfered some supplies for breakfast from an all-night corner store and headed to meet their colleagues in a run-down warehouse in the East End of London. They were warmly greeted in many different tongues by the men and a few women who had made the self-same journey over the preceding few years. They numbered over 1,000, and the two newcomers wondered at the omerta that had meant they had never been betrayed as they plotted for the denouement that was to come. Moreover, the no-questions-asked manner in which each had been released was matched only by the no-questions-asked manner in which each had been able to enter surreptitiously into the country in the first place. The careful series of burglaries, murders, rapes, and assaults, and the inconvenient periods of incarceration that followed, had been necessary steps to assemble and train this now full team of members. Denouement, as they called it, was drawing close. The planning had been meticulous. The vast majority had infiltrated themselves into hospitals and care centres across the land, clandestinely learning the arcane arts of mouthing insincere platitudes, jabbing blunt needles into arms, avoiding soap, having affairs with doctors, molesting patients, and complaining about pay. Once they had acquired the smart-looking uniforms, perky silicone implants, coiffured wigs, skin-whitening creams, and immaculate makeup, they became indistinguishable from the genuine exponents. Late at night, they would gather inside the warehouse and practice booing and heckling in that curious way a well-brought-up gal does when she's pretending to be a football hooligan, which, since many of them were in fact male football hooligans in disguise, and foreign ones at that, was not so difficult. But there were specialist operators as well. One of the bravest had volunteered to get close to, in fact, to get to know in the biblical sense, one of the enemy's chief lieutenants, a particularly revolting specimen known for his meatiness as brisket. For 2 long years, she had endured his halitosis, clammy hands, outside belly, B.O., inarticulate endearments, and of course that fate worse than death. Never once letting her blonde wig slip, even beneath the ministerial desk, even when Brisket tried to strangle her daily in front of the mirror, as worry lines traced across her temple. Other suspiciously well-tanned specialists had acquired blimey accents and were given substantial budgets to implement their subversive plans. Their task was to use the funds to suborn the higher echelons of the regime. In exchange, they would be granted unprecedented accolades, law-making abilities, and fur-lined cloaks. Apparently such baubles are much sought after, for they instantly elevate you to the most rarefied reaches of society. Though these manoeuvres were conducted with the utmost secrecy, word of them got out ahead of denouement, which spoiled the effect little, though did not divert from the overall objective. At last, denouement itself arrived, 27th of April, or 27-4, as it would henceforth be known. All at once, they let it be known that all 1,023 of them had got out of prison scot-free, and instead of being peremptorily deported, which is the proper privilege of every foreign crook, had disappeared into the community, where they waited to pounce again. Wearing a grim expression and a smart pair of unmatched Clark brogues, Charlie, all whiskers, dome, and ears, for he it was who was the jailer in chief, said he was sorry, but there was no better man than he to catch them all again. If I can let them go, I can gather them up and kick 'em out, he he didn't say. After this bravura performance, no one would trust the state ever again to protect the security of the nation. The newspapers and TV loved it. Another example of the incompetence and chicanery of the dear leader. "Give that man a peerage," the journalist said. "He may not have made a loan, but by God, he made our day." There was more. Simultaneously, and as per plan, the Brisket scandal was launched with more abusive photos showing him manhandling the unfortunate blonde across a crowded room, assaulting her with his belly, making her remove his shirt to launder it. Journalist heaven. Yet this man was none other than the deputy to the dear leader himself, a veritable demigod on earth, and indeed, after his antics, also a sex god, according to some. Then came the pièce de résistance, the annual conference of the Royal College of Disappeared Alien Scoundrels, each delegate purporting to be a concerned nurse. They were solemnly addressed by none other than the very same phony blonde who had so recently escaped the clumsy clutches of Brisket. Calling herself Patsy Blowit, for reasons only Brisket would understand, she stood defiantly before the 1,022 nurses, whilst the TV cameras whirled and reporters scribbled in their notebooks, with not a single one noticing the unmistakable coincidence over numbers. She congratulated them on the undeserved pay increase they had secured and for wrecking the finances of the health service, and told them that their services would be redundant after the conference, as they had now successfully subverted the security, the health, and the governance of the nation. How they cheered their sister to the rooftops, not a few clad, of course, in best ermine. And how the assembled media lapped it up in their blissful ignorance, though they tended to spell cheer with a J. Quadruple quandary then for the dear leader. Can he ever survive? Of course he can, because if his own future is grim and grey, the future without him is a dastardly dark brown. What could be more scary?